From the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're listening to Earth First Radio. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
You're cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, destroying everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. Can we stand by while this all takes place? We've got to stop this inhuman race.
Welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Each week I bring you No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music for activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. In the news you'll hear tonight about folks who are killing the planet and folks who are saving the planet and folks who have detailed information. They all have addresses, names, phone numbers, fax numbers, email, and web addresses, so go get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information, because this isn't couch potato radio. It's activist radio, and I urge you to take the information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, sending faxes, and making phone calls when you aren't out in the woods up in a tripod or a tree sit, or locked down at the road blockade. If you have information announcements or comments or anything else for Earth First Radio, please keep your pencil handy and listen for the contact addresses later on in the show. And let's get right on into the news. We're going to start off with nominees for the 1999 Darwin Awards. Or are these the actual winners of the 1999 Darwin Awards? Okay, I guess some were runners-up. Here we go. A man in Alabama died from rattlesnake bites. Not so odd, you may say, but there's a twist here that makes him a candidate for the Darwin Awards. It seems he and his friend were playing catch with a rattlesnake. You can guess what happened from here. The friend, a future Darwin Awards candidate, was hospitalized. And the runner-up this year for the Darwin Awards is a Vermont native, Ronald DeMuth. Found himself in a difficult position while touring the Eagles Rock African Safari Zoo with a group of thespians from St. Petersburg, Russia. Mr. DeMuth went overboard to show them one of America's many marvels. He demonstrated the effectiveness of crazy glue the hard way. Apparently, Mr. DeMuth wanted to demonstrate just how good the adhesive was, so he put about 3 ounces of it on his palm of his hands and jokingly placed them on the buttocks of a passing rhino. The rhino, a resident of the zoo for the past 13 years, was definitely not startled, as it had been part of the petting exhibit since its arrival as a baby. However, once it became aware of its being involuntarily stuck to Mr. DeMuth, it began to panic and ran around the petting area wildly, making Mr. DeMuth an unintended passenger. Sally, that is the rhino, hasn't been feeling well lately. She's been very constipated, and we had just given her a laxative and some depressant to relax her bowels when Mr. DeMuth played his juvenile prank, said James Douglas, the caretaker at the zoo. During Sally's tirade, 2 fences were destroyed, a shed wall gored, and a number of small animals escaped. Also during the stampede, 3 pygmy goats and 1 duck were stomped to death. As for DeMuth, it took a team of medics and zoo caretakers over 4 hours to remove his hands from the rhino's buttocks. First, the animal had to be captured and calmed down. However, during this process, the laxatives began to take hold, and Mr. DeMuth was repeatedly showered with over 30 gallons of rhino diarrhea. It was tricky. We had to calm her down while at the same time shield our faces from being pelted with rhino dung. I guess you could say Mr. DeMuth was into it up to his neck. Once the rhino was under control, we had 3 people with shovels working to keep an air passage open for Mr. DeMuth. We were able to tranquilize the rhino and apply a solvent to remove the hands from her rear, said Douglas. I don't think he'll be playing with crazy glue for a while. Meanwhile, the Russians, while obviously amused, were also impressed with the power of the adhesive. I'm going to buy some for my children, but of course I can't take it to the zoo, commented Vladimir Zolnikov, leader of the troop. All right, another animal news. Herons are flying high, but cuckoos are crashing. A survey of 24 species of Britain's flying birds shows over half a dozen of them have increased in the last year. But the British Trust for Ornithology, whose volunteers conducted the census, say the declines in some species were cause for concern. And in the tiny town of Martell in western Wisconsin, residents are trying to stop a big new dairy farm they fear will pollute one of the best trout streams in the Midwest, the Rush River, about an hour's drive east of the Twin Cities. It's the same kind of battle small towns and rural residents are fighting across the Midwest as large-scale livestock operations continue to expand. A man has shot and killed a timber wolf in Wisconsin, claiming that he thought it was a coyote. The wolf had recently been trapped on a game farm in the state and had been relocated days before it was shot. Prior to being trapped, the State Department of Natural Resources has requested permission to shoot the wolf because it was feeding on a captive deer. The man who killed the wolf turned himself in and faces federal fines of up to $100,000 and lesser state fines. Wolf killings in Wyoming, however, have only resulted in fines of $500 when the killers alleged they had thought the wolf was a coyote. Gene Braveheart of the Minnesota Wolf Alliance said, "I have a concern that the man who shot and killed the wolf will get off too easily. It reminds me of the person who killed a condor in Arizona and said, I thought it was a raven." And now we have some commentary from Earth First Radio Network commentator Oak.
Coyote is a mystical character in Native American lore, the trickster, shape-changer, a creature earning both the people's respect and disdain. Out west, here in some quarters of the Four Corners, coyote's life comes pretty cheap. I was browsing through a local paper recently when I came upon a notice for a coyote calling contest. Intriguing, I thought. I wonder how and why. Reading further down, I discovered why. Why? To shoot them, of course. I also discovered that the contest was being held on an Indian reservation southwest of here. It struck me as a bit odd, shooting one's own cultural icons, so I gave a call. The how of it, I was told by a friendly voice on the other end, is that teams of two go out into the desert with a rabbit caller, two blocks of wood designed to mimic the sound of a wounded rabbit, and try to attract as many coyotes as possible. Then they kill them. Now, I'm no faint-hearted Easterner. When I headed west, I knew all about fence rows being strung with dead coyote carcass, shot, trapped, poisoned. I knew ranchers and even a government agency did these things ostensibly to protect sheep and cows. I knew some did it out of habit. Others did it for a peculiar idea of fun. But I was a bit surprised to find native people killing coyotes for the sport of it. I'm pretty sure no one's eating dead coyotes, and I'll bet their pelts aren't in great demand either. So I use the term sport advisedly. That leaves only a few rather questionable reasons for the mass execution of one of our fellow creatures. Reasons that don't really fit into my understanding of traditional native views on the balance of nature. Of course, not all native people, and certainly fewer non-native folks, hold with such tradition. And it may be that such an event as a coyote calling contest helps to bring cowboys and Indians together. No small feat, given their troubled history. However, on the surface, it appears that coyote is the loser in this bargain. I say appears because I hear there are today more coyotes than there were when cattle ranchers first started blasting away at them. Coyote's not called the trickster for nothing. Back east, my neighbor shot my dog for going after his goats. Fair enough, I'd have done the same to his, had I a gun and goats. I sure have no quarrel with any rancher or sheepherder gunning down some critter he or she finds going after their livelihood, provided that livelihood is in keeping with the balance of things. But it seems to me, no matter where it occurs, east or west, that a body stepping over the line and out of balance when it comes to making sport out of wholesale slaughter.
And that was some commentary by Oak for the Earth First Radio Network. Back into animal news, environmentalists have asked a federal judge to call a temporary halt to all logging on the 24.4 million acres of federal land in Washington, Oregon, and California, where spotted owls live, the environmentalists argument. Drastic action is warranted because, according to a recent U.S. Forest Service report, the owl population is declining at a rate four times faster than the Clinton administration predicted it would under the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan. The plan isn't working, said Tom Hermack, executive director of the Native Forest Council, a Eugene, Oregon-based environmental group. Forest Service report says that while the rate of the owl's population decline has slowed since the bird became a household word in the late 1980s, it is still dropping by about 3.9% a year. The forest plan's target for the population to be falling today by just 1% a year. Forest Service officials say the environmentalists are missing the good news in the report, which is the conclusion that the threatened species is on the path towards recovery. What we see now is that the rate of decline is dropping, said Rex Holloway, a spokesman for the agency's Pacific Northwest Region office in Portland. We cannot expect overnight results. This is a long-term plan, and to make a difference is going to take some time. That doesn't cut it for the environmentalists. Citing the report, the Native Forest Council and the John Muir Project of Pasadena, California, filed a motion with U.S. District Court Judge William Dwyer of Seattle last month, seeking a ban on timber harvest while the Forest Service conducts a more extensive owl study. The Forest Service hasn't responded to the motion, and Mr. Holloway says agency officials can't comment on pending litigation. Canada and the United States have reached an agreement to conserve and rebuild their shared West Coast salmon runs under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. The agreement sets quotas for dividing the catch between the two countries' fishermen for the next 10 years. And the National Park Service agrees to review the impact of snowmobiles. The service will assess the impact of snowmobiles having on the park system in response to a request from environmentalists to ban the machines. And scientists in Wales are planning a trial to turn willow wood into fuel of the future, transforming hard-up farms into forests of alternative energy. And smugglers trap Nigeria's endangered gray parrots to the brink of extinction. Until recently, when the people of Ikoti Village raised alarm about the rapid rate at which the African gray parrots are being smuggled out of Nigeria, the illegal export of the colorful bird has largely been going on for years unnoticed. A new study entitled Wilderness in a Landscape Context, conducted by the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station and the Ecology Center, showed the current network of wilderness areas is unable to maintain complete aquatic ecosystems. The study used the Aquatic Diversity Areas approach, which combines information on road densities, fish stocking history, native and exotic fish presence, the sensitive species occurrences, to quantify the health of watersheds in western Montana. The study's co-author, Dr. Christopher Frizzle of University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station, stated, "Our results point out that in the absence of additional land protection and changes in wildlife management practices, the existing wilderness is not sufficient to achieve effective conservation of our native aquatic species." If you'd like further information, contact the Wild Rockies InfoNet at news@wildrockies.org. That's news@wildrockies.org. And faced with mounting resentment to the proliferation of new fees being charged at parks, forests, and other public recreations, government agencies are searching for a more acceptable way to levy and collect these user fees. Meeting in Boise last week, federal and state land managers explored options for creating a universal access pass that would be valid at all public lands in the state of Idaho. This information was learned by Scott Silver, executive director of Wild Wilderness, in a phone conversation with Rick Just, Public Affairs Office for Idaho Parks and Rec. Mr. Silver claims that the confidential sources tipped him off to last week's meeting in which the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, and the Idaho Department of State Parks representatives discussed ideas for combining numerous user fee programs into one easy-to-purchase pass. Silver inquired how such a universal pass would ensure user fees would continue to benefit the specific area that the purchaser actually visited. Silver noted that the U.S. Forest Service and other supporters of these fees said the ability to retain fees locally is a major benefit of moving toward customer pay recreation funding. Mr. Just said that this was just one of the issues being considered. Wild Wilderness and Earth First are vocal opponents of the recreational fee demonstration program, first introduced in 1996 to test the feasibility of charging for what once were considered public amenities. Wild Wilderness and over 100 organizations say the introduction of recreational user fees will promote additional commercialization, privatization, and motorization of recreational opportunities on America's public lands. For more information, contact www.wildwilderness.org on your web page. Okay, check that out. And Senator Ron Wyden is giving qualified support to a controversial ski area planned for the old-growth forests on an 8,000-foot Pelican Butte in southern Oregon, a development that would tap into a roadless area of federal forests. My view on Pelican Butte is essentially the same as Senator Kitzhaber's, Wyden said Friday at a town hall meeting at Oregon Institute of Technology. In March, Governor John Kitzhaber, expressed tentative support for Pelican Butte in a four-page letter responding to the project's environmental impact statement, a document identifying possible environmental concerns at the site approximately 38 miles northwest of Klamath Falls, Oregon. Although I believe these adverse impacts can be mitigated, I want to be clear that they must be adequately addressed before I can support the Pelican Butte project, Kitzhaber's letter stated. The Northwest Forest Plan has not put the national forest off limits to human use. Instead, it has provided us with a way to manage and enjoy these lands consistent with species protection. The development has been a flashpoint for environmentalists, including the National Audubon Society and the Sierra Club, who have filed a federal lawsuit to stall the plan. They say the presence of endangered bald eagles and spotted owls, plus the possible presence of species like lynx, should make the mountain off-limits to development. While giving guarded support to the project, Wyden encouraged environmentalists and those favoring economic development to work together towards a solution. Both sides have just enough clout to tie everyone up in court, he said. And in an effort to promote clear-cutting, the Pennsylvania Bureau of Forestry is releasing a taxpayer-funded children's book entitled Let's Talk About Clear-Cutting, a Forestry Book for Youth. The book tries to convince the unwary child there is nothing wrong with clear-cutting. The book fails to mention the potential long-term problems of even-aged forests artificially created by clear-cutting. Erosion, invasive species, and predation problems caused by logging roads, the inability of wildlife to successfully move from clear-cut areas because of their territorial nature, and the simple fact that forests evolved for millions of years without logging. The book closes with, so you see, when clear-cutting is done in the right place, in the right way, and at the right time, it can be good for people, good for wildlife, and good for the forest. To view a copy of the book online, visit www.dcnr.state.pa.us/forestry/clearcut/maine.htm. That webpage again is www.dcnr.state.pa.us/forestry/clearcut/maine.htm. This shameful production is education at its worst. Unfortunately, many forestry departments refuse to accept the overwhelming scientific evidence against clear-cutting from wildlife biologists, hydrologists, and ecologists. Let the Pennsylvania Bureau of Forestry know what you think of this book, and go right to that website, www.dcnr.state.pa.us/forestry, and let them know how you feel. In a recent conference sponsored by the National Wildlife Federation and the Hells Canyon Preservation Council, wolf activists and ranchers discussed the prospect of reintroducing wolves into Oregon. The conference was inspired by B45, a female wolf spotted in February that is the first wild wolf confirmed in Oregon since 1964. While it seems no wolves will be released in Oregon, Ed Bangs of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service expects it is just a matter of time before more wolves make their way across the Snake River and into Oregon. And the 1,493,444-acre Hell's Canyon Chief Joseph National Preserve would be protected by the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, H.R. 488, now before the 106th Congress. To learn more about the area, please visit June's Wild Rockies Bioregional Spotlight at www.wildrockies.org and follow the leads to their spotlight section for June. And please call your representative and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 488. The timber officials stood three deep and shoulder to shoulder behind Governor Gary Locke on Monday as he signed landmark legislation intended to protect fish from loggers and loggers from environmental regulators in Washington. The officials, that's Washington State, by the way, the officials who were joined by politicians and some tribal leaders clapped and cheered when Locke signed the measure after saying it offered threatened wild salmon the highest level of protection on forest lands of any state in the nation. But outside the governor's packed conference room, environmentalists handed out news releases lambasting the legislation, which guarantees the timber industry the right to cut trees unmolested by environmental regulations in exchange for significant changes in logging practices intended to protect salmon. This bill is a sellout to the timber industry, pure and simple, said David Mann, president of the Washington Environmental Council. It gives the timber industry control of future logging rules, gives them a multi-million dollar tax cut, and allows them to continue to cut trees too close to streams, threatening salmon and water quality, Mann said. Locke, key lawmakers, and industry and some tribal leaders had a far different interpretation of the hard-fought legislation crafted in negotiations among the industry and state and federal regulators over the past 2 years. They call it imaginative, groundbreaking way to meet restrictions of the Federal Endangered Species Act as it is increasingly applied to wild salmon runs and still maintain a viable timber industry. They say the measure lauded by the National Marine Fisheries Service as sufficient to protect salmon is the best way to avoid economic turmoil caused when the act was invoked 9 years ago to protect threatened northern spotted owl. In short, said Bill Wilkerson, executive director of the trade group Washington Forest Protection Association, the agreement means the industry has a future. Essentially, the Forested Fish Agreement will allow loggers to operate for 50 years with impunity in areas considered home to federally endangered or threatened salmon, in exchange for giving up to $2 billion worth of timber along streams and rivers and on steep hillsides. The loggers will also rehabilitate logging roads considered a threat to salmon streams. Owners of small timber lots will receive 50% state compensation for trees left standing in sensitive habitat. And as partial compensation, the industry will get a modest tax break, a credit of 0.8% on the timber excise tax. The reduction will be worth about $6 million a year across the industry. Officials with the National Marine Fisheries Service told lawmakers in hearings on the proposal this winter that passage would virtually exempt the industry from federal intervention and third-party lawsuits contending loggers were damaging the salmon habitat. Wilkerson said he was relieved the measure was signed into law, but added there is an awful lot of work to do, and much of it will be contentious. The State Forest Practices Board, the agency that regulates logging practices in Washington, is expected as early as next week to begin writing emergency rules to put the act into place, state officials said. Coming up this weekend is a workshop in San Luis Obispo, California. Workshop topics include important background information on what wilderness protection means, a discussion of potential new wilderness areas around the state of California, and most importantly, you can learn about how to get involved in the Wildlands 2000 campaign and make your mark on California's conservation history. Where's this happening? Well, it's June 13th from 10 to 5:30 p.m. at the San Luis Obispo Recreation Center, Room A, in 1341 Nipomo Street in San Luis Obispo. Presented by the California Wilderness Coalition and the Sierra Club, there'll be a slideshow, a workshop, and field training regarding Wildlands 2000. After the workshop, the California Wilderness Coalition staff will lead a wilderness survey training in the Los Padres National Forest southeast of San Luis Obispo from 12:30 to 5:30. Please bring a hat, sunscreen, rain gear, boots, sturdy shoes, water, lunch, pocketbook, notebook, and a pen or pencil. For more information, contact Letty French at 805-239-7338. That's 805-239-7338. Well, that's it for news and announcements here on Earth First Radio. To get your news, announcements, comments, or whatever from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzeef at cruzeio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or send your letters, donations, CDs, cassettes, or whatever to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. And for more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, subscribe to the Earth First Journal. They're at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Earth First Radio is broadcast live each on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday evening at 8 o'clock, or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer. We're at the World Wide Web. It's at radioforall.web.net. That's http://radio4, the number 4, all, radioforall.web.net. You'll need a sound card, but the software you need is free for downloading on the website. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, including Free Radio Eugene and Free Radio Austin. If you found us on the web, please ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again. And we're going to go play some music here. This one is called The Sinkione. It's by Daryl Cherney, and it's off his cassette, I Had to Be Born This Century.
Oh, Sinkione, you bear such a noble name. Oh, Sinkione, a testament to white man's shame. The boss at Georgia Pacific, he needs to make some dough. So sorry, California, those redwoods gotta go. Oh, Sinkione, can't let them cut you down. Oh, Sinkione, they don't care that it's sacred ground. They massacred the Indians, they stole the land they left. But now they come to tell us that I'm finished with their theft. Oh, Sinkione, your spirit is so great. Well, Sinkione, I can't believe this is your fate. The boss at Georgia Pacific, he likes to feel his might, but none can match the power of Mother Nature's might. Well, wants to cut you bare. Someday his own grandchildren will walk on barren soil, while from the shorelines they can watch the oil rigs dig for oil. Oh, Sinkione, we cannot let this be. Oh, Sinkione, we can't let them touch one tree. The mother must not suffer for the profit of a few. Hey, boss at Georgia Pacific,